Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show-jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 25 with Lisa Laurie of Spike Host Farm in the USA. Lisa is a breeder, a stallion owner, an international show-jumping owner, a philanthropist, and much more. And in this episode, we discuss how Lisa went from breeding her first sport horses 20 years ago to now becoming one of the most prominent and largest sport horse breeding programs in the USA. We discuss some of the efforts that Lisa and others went into encouraging and improving breeding in the US, some of the registration issues that existed, young horse production in the USA, breeder recognition, and much, much more. At the moment, you seem to be breeding around 50 foals a year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what the very first foal that you bred was?
Yes.
And when was that?
It was back around 2001 or 2002. It was a thoroughbred. I had a school teacher, kind of a hunter, that I was riding. And I thought it'd be great fun to breed her. She was such a great minded horse, and I didn't know anything about breeding at all. And there was a thoroughbred stud not far from me. And so I thought, oh, you know, I'll breed a thoroughbred. And so I bred Spy on the Devil. He was my first one. And then I bred another one out of a claimed mare named Minerale, and took that mare to Maryland to breed to a stud down there. And so I had the horses out in the field, and somebody mentioned to me a couple of years later, they said, so what are you doing with these horses? And I said, oh, you know, I'm waiting for them to grow up. And they said, they'd already be on the track by now. You do know that, right? And I was like, what? They said, that three-year-old would be running on the track and that two-year-old would be in training. I was like, oh no, they're too young for that. They can't do that. And they said, yeah, well, and that was the end of my thoroughbred career. It's like, then I realized, oh wow, I know nothing about breeding thoroughbreds, and I could lose my shirt at this because it's a, you know, it's a big organized venture, and I'm not doing it anyway. I'm not involved in any way in racing. So I looked at sport horses after that, and I said, well, this is what I'm actually doing. My daughter and I are actually riding. So maybe that's what I ought to do, because I know that they don't even go into the ring until they're five or six or whatever. I was much more suited to that. But Spy on the Devil ended up being a very good hunter, and one of the best hunter judges almost bought Spy on the Devil, but he had some arthritis in his front limbs, in his front fetlocks. And that led me to support some research in cartilage development and repair in horses at Gluck Equine Research Institute, because I figured he was a one-off. He was the first one I ever bred. So he spent a lot of time sort of in a stall and not having playmates to run around with. And it's true that to lay down the proper kind of cartilage, which is sort of a matrix, they have to move around a lot and play. That's part of their development. And he suffered physically because he didn't actually have that activity level. So I learned something, obviously. So that was my first one. Mickey, we used to call him.
Who came up with the name Spy on the Devil?
Me. Because by then I knew it was going to be Spy Coast Farm. And I thought,
okay,
I could name them all something to do with spy. And then I was like, yeah, well, that's not going to happen. After a while, there were too many.
Yeah, so. Because I meant to ask you, where did Spy Coast come out of?
During the Revolutionary War, General Washington, George Washington, commissioned a spy ring. And it operated out of Setauket, New York, which is where my farm was at that time.
Okay.
And Manhattan and in Connecticut. And where my farm was kind of known in the area as the Spy Coast as a result.
Okay.
And so it was like a nod to the history of the area. Yeah.
And from breeding Spy on the Devil to then going down the sport horse breeding route, what was the timeline there? When did you breed your first sport horses?
It was pretty much continuous. It was so I bred one or two a year from probably when Spine the Devil was about two. So I really started breeding in about 2003 is when I started breeding a couple a year typically. Can't remember all of them, but sort of I bred to one that was kind of dressagey, ended up being a dressage horse, which was great because I formed a relationship with a very famous dressage rider, Toonie Page, and she's still a great friend. And so it's always good to have connections with people who go in the direction that your horse wants to go in, because they're not all going to be show jumpers, right? And at the time, I wasn't really doing show jumping. My daughter and I were doing hunters, and she was just getting into the children's jumpers. So it was very much a factor of getting involved with Shane Sweetnam that led me very much in the vein of breeding top show jumpers.
Do you remember the moment or what the switch was or the conversations? Because depending on obviously where you are in the US, there's probably not the same widespread breeding culture. There's pockets and there's individuals that are really focused on what they're doing. But say in comparison to maybe some of the European countries where it's more widespread throughout the countries, it's a
Yeah, I
bit
remember the moment.
unusual to, yeah.
Yeah, I remember pretty much the exact moment. My daughter was doing the high junior jumpers. So this is a number of years down the road, maybe 3 or 4 more years down the road. So I was doing a little breeding, checking it out, trying things. We had met Shane by then. So he was riding one or two horses for me, but I was sitting in the international club there at Wellington, and my daughter was doing the high junior jumpers, and I'm watching endless rounds. I was a good show mom, stayed off to the side, let Shane do his job. And I began to wonder what happened. These are the best horses on the show ground, I remember thinking. These are better than the Grand Prix horses because they're built for amateurs. And they are serving amateurs. And a lot of them were former Grand Prix horses that had come down, were coming down. And these kids, I mean, they were saving their butts left and right. Sometimes the kids would chip and this and that, but the horses were fantastic. So I started watching how they went, learning their pedigrees, and wondering, what happens to these horses at the end of the day? If they get injured or if they just age out. And the answer was nothing. They weren't really doing anything with these horses. They weren't sending them back to Europe. They were just turning them out in the field. And I thought that's a real wasted resource. And nobody was picking them up. And interestingly, Europe wasn't requiring them to be sent back in order to have access to the next round. So, coming from a healthcare background, access is a huge deal. So,
Could you just
you
touch
wouldn't
on
know
that a
that
little
from
bit?
Ireland. You
Yeah,
wouldn't
what?
know that. You wouldn't know that in Ireland, but here in the US, you don't necessarily walk into any hospital and get access. You have to have the right insurance or have the right doctor. And if you don't have the right insurance, you may not get that doctor. So, access is huge. So, in other words, why weren't the Europeans saying, okay, you send that really good mare back to us, the bloodlines that I really like, and we'll make available to you the next, great thing, right? Well, they weren't doing that at the time, and started collecting some really nice mares and just utilizing them and testing how they bred. And then Shane had an edict to only buy mares and stallions. He couldn't buy geldings for me. And they had to have good bloodlines, and the stallions had to be fertile as well. So he really, I had one hand tied behind his back, right? But that was fine. He was like, okay, I'll do it. And he did. He did really well. So when, each stallion that would come on, I'd breed a few too to see how they bred. And basically did a little micro version of what they do over in Europe, but I didn't have the option to do big numbers, so I did little numbers, and saw what came of it. So it took about 10 years or so of just trial and error to figure out maybe you don't do it this way. Maybe you just breed the very best to the very best to know what those dam lines are and know what the stallion lines are and just breed the very best to the very best.
And I think on that point, I think those first 10 years could be just useful to touch on or reflect on here. Looking back, what were the main stumbling blocks or the main areas which now you feel weren't done the right way, or why some of those breedings weren't maybe succeeding in the way that you wanted them to be?
Well, mostly because I didn't know how consistently the mare, it's all about numbers, right? So it's all about the consistency of how something throws, whether it be a sire or whether it be the dam. So if that dam hasn't been bred or that dam line isn't a well-known dam line to produce top horses, you'll never know unless you try it. And even then, it's going to be kind of up and down, right? You're going to hit some and not hit others. And if you breed to different sires, you don't know whether it's the sire or the dam or the mixture. So you sort of have to get an idea of what you're going to spend your resources on at the end of the day. So you do make mistakes. There are some sires that and dams that will consistently throw, say, some anomaly, parrot mouth or a lot of OCDs or something like that. And then there are some that will almost always throw something very marketable. It may not be the top horse, it may not have all the scope, but they're really easy to deal with and they'll always have a job and they're very marketable. And one of the things I learned was, or another light bulb that went on was my target market, my market in the United States, it's 99% amateurs. That I realized early on. So I said to Shane, I have to be able to go in that stallion stall, me personally, and handle that stallion. If I can't do that, it doesn't have a good enough brain for me to breed to and market those foals. And that was another thing
I was just
that
thinking that.
I
Another box on his garage.
Everybody thinks Shane's had it easy. No, he hasn't at all. He's
Yeah.
done double, triple duty than most guys, than most riders. Yeah, he had to deal with me too. He was really interested in it. He thought it was crazy at first, of course, but then he got it. He understood why breeding was important for what he was doing too.
And to go from there, where it's semi-experimental and you're finding your feet, from there to a situation where you start building up Spycoast Farm in Lexington to a 50-fold, crop. What was it about those first few years? Because it was obviously some things that, or some results that were favorable, or you were seeing glimmers of hope, or you were seeing something that was motivating, or a business opportunity to go from that to decide, right, we're making a really serious investment in building a farm here. What motivated you to do that?
What I wanted was nothing less to encourage breeding in America. That's what I wanted. Big, big thing. I'm a process person. For me, it was about the whole process of learning how to do this, getting better at it, seeing how the horses did, what could I learn, what could I do better, how to train the horses better, how to establish a training program, and how needle in the United States. And to do that, I had to discover what all the problems were, right? And one of the biggest, for example, was there was no registration required for warm bloods. None, zero. So how can you have a breeding program if you don't know who's who and how old they are?
Can't.
And there was a huge problem of everybody changing the names. The Europeans were really upset because as soon as the horse would come over here, the name would get changed and they'd get lost. They couldn't follow them. So there was a lot of actually administrative work to be done. And there, myself and three other people really worked very hard on that aspect of it. And it was not easy. I mean, it was like banging our heads against the wall at USEF for a long time, United States Equestrian Federation.
Yes.
So, but finally it got put through. And then we could start, really start in earnest what we were doing.
And when you're saying it that, got put through, what got put through? And I suppose
required registration. So, okay. So the thoroughbreds were doing it, right?
Yep.
They've got the jockey club. Mm-hmm. They've got all their pedigrees. They know who's who. Morgan horses knows who's who. Quarter horses knew who was who. You know, all these horses knew. But when it came to warm bloods, nobody cared because they wanted to be able to recreate the horse somewhere else. If it started stopping or mm-hmm. something like that, then they could send it across the country and sell it as something else. It was okay. Really virtually no tracking.
And why
and all the data was no good. All the data was no good at that point.
Yeah. It was something why I wanted to just hold on that point was I know there are going to be a group of breeders who are incredibly motivated and trying to do something very similar. So in New Zealand, there's this core group of breeders who are really trying to put some structures in place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm glad you brought that up, because I think you had a very similar situation in the US, and it's from a breeding or a structure point of view or any sort of breeding progress point of view, it's absolute chaos. You know, it's obviously made massive improvements.
And the way we finally did it was we went back to USEF and we said, listen, you cannot have a 5, 6, and 7-year-old final. You cannot have pre-green hunters. You can't legitimately do that because you don't know how old these horses are and what they've done before. You have no clue.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, no, we can do it. We can do it. I said, no, you're going to get sued and bad because these horses, oh, no. And we thought it was going to go through the jumpers because, you know, they're more structured and objective. And we were sort of writing off the hunters. But my good friend Summer Stoffel went to the head of the USGA, and she said, and with data, she was our data person. And she showed her what the composition of the most recent pre-green hunter final was. And 80% of it, they had already done like a meter 45 over in Europe. They were like 12 years old and like all these like crazy things. And so Mary Babick was like, oh, whoa. And within weeks, we had registration.
Because it unavoidable. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were like, not only can we not breed, because we were all breeders, but you're in trouble, you know, and your data will never be good. That database you're keeping, it'll never be okay. Because you don't know what the starting point is.
With those earlier mares, when you were getting the retired competition horses, when did it get to a stage where you found yourself becoming really selective on the type of mare that you were willing to take on?
Probably about 10 years in. That's when Shane especially came to me and he said, and I knew it anyway, but he said, listen, we're going to cull most of these mares. Okay. He said, we're going to only go with the best of the best. And we were all in agreement at that point. And we had a couple of really good bloodlines. So we were just going to focus in on those for a while. And then things all changed then Europe caught up with us with ICSI. So you were able to buy, and Mares of Matcha came along. Mm-hmm. So you're able to buy into excellent bloodlines without having to own the mare. And that's a sea change in breeding as far as I'm concerned.
And I'll come back to that in a minute, but in terms of those few mares that you decided to focus on,
mm-hmm.
who are some of those mares at the time in those 10 years in the mares that you decided to really focus on as your core group?
Well, Whirly Chindamuse, obviously, she's one of the best bloodlines in the world, and her offspring, some of her offspring. We focused in on Roulette, but she did not turn out to be a particularly good broodmare. We got one or two pretty good ones out of her, but she was not, I wouldn't say that that was the line that I was going to pin my hopes on. But then we had a few kind of surprises in some of the mares that Shane was showing. I had a particular love for Heartbreaker because my daughter rode a Heartbreaker and I love their hind ends. And Shane's like, yeah, but they're kind of difficult to ride. Their mouths are crummy. But I was like, yeah, but they're great to watch. And so I was trying to go in that direction. He had a mare named Una Donja that he rode, and she has produced a couple of good ones. But then there were surprise ones like Billy Bianca and Beluga. They ended up producing fairly well. So as soon as we found some who were producing consistently, who was another one, Damascus, you know, these were ones either Shane had ridden or he really liked. See, I have the advantage of, I have a really good rider in the ring and in the practice ring. So he knows how those horses are going, particularly in the practice ring. That's where you really want to see what's going on. And he could talk to the guys there, and they knew I was breeding. So the riders would come over and say, hey, you know, I have this mare, she's injured, or she's, you know, she's aging out, she's not going to be able to do it anymore. Would you be interested in her for your breeding program? And so we were able to get in some of the better lines that way.
At the moment now, am I right in saying that the majority of the foals born at Spycoast are embryo transfer foals rather than carried in their own mothers?
Yes. Either embryo transfer or ICSI. Yeah. They're in surrogates. Not the majority. Well, we always have a good mix, and we would like to have a good mix because we're breeding the second or third in some case, well, the second generation now. So we let them carry, you know, some of them, like we'll let them carry one. It opens up their cervix. It gives them a little more time. You know, the more fractious ones, it kind of calms them down for a little while. So sometimes we breed those much as they do in Europe.
So one or two foals before going into sport, for example.
Usually maybe one if we think it's going to be a really important mare, or we collect embryos off of her. If we don't feel we want to touch her and just let her go, we'll get some embryos off of her. Yeah. And then, you know, so that's how we perpetuate the ones that we really think are going to be good.
Was it Whirly Chin then that brought you first in contact with Mare Zamacha that you mentioned a few minutes ago?
Yes. Yes. They wanted her very badly.
And that then has led into, looking from the outside, a partnership between the two of you. How does that look, and what were the kind of the goals or visions when there was that coming together?
Well, they wanted Whirly Chin, and they came, you know, and I said, no, you can't have her, but I'll sell you a daughter. Who, she had a really nice daughter, actually, that had broken her leg when she was two out in the field. And she was fine, but she wasn't obviously going to go into sport. And her growth was a bit stunted as a result, too. She was a little on the shorter side. So, but she was a lovely mare, and she still had the genetic material. So I said, you know, I'll sell you that one, because I had several more fillies from her as well that were moving along. And so they bought her. And then Klaus DeCoster came over here, and he had already come to Kentucky. And then he came down to Wellington, and we spent quite a lot of time together. And finally he looked at me and he said, you're kind of like you're the person that people go to over here, aren't you? And I said, well, kind of, yeah, because nobody else is as visible. I had established a really good footprint. You know what I mean? So, so Klaus took note of that. And he said, you know, I'd really like to form a relationship with you in order to have you be the person, because I could find a horse for him. You know, if he said, do you know where Seacoast Farley is? And I'd say, oh yeah, I know who owns her. And oh, you know, and he'd asked me to run. I said, don't waste your time. They're not going to sell that horse. They won't. I've tried three times to buy it and they will not sell that horse, or, you know, that kind of thing. I could use as an advisory role for him. And then eventually I sold him Wurlitzer. You know, I just said, you know what? I've gotten a lot of foals off of this mare, and I really believe in the vision of Mares of Matcha, how it democratizes the breeding industry. All you need is, you know, the money, but you don't need gobs of money, right? Mm-hmm. So a gold or platinum mare, I don't know which one it is, it's like $25,000, not cheap for a frozen embryo. But if you get a filly off of that, it's, you know, worth a lot of money, even a stallion. But if you're a breeder, that's great. You're in, you've got that bloodline.
That's your foundation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So where you're not spending millions for the mare.
Yeah. So, and like if you were trying to buy the same level of genetics or something out of the equivalent of the thoroughbred world, it's inaccessible to most.
Exactly. So I was very much on board with the accessibility. So now I buy quite a few from Mares of Matcha every year because that expands my bloodlines and I'm able to get my heartbreakers that I like, things like that.
Finally.
Secret desire of Lisa Laurie. But yeah, I think it's a great concept, and now other people are mimicking it, of course. But they were there first and they really got in and they pushed it hard, and they've got a very good mix of people who work. Their partnership is very strong, you know, with Peter DeVos and with Frederick.
Yes.
And all. It's a very strong partnership. They know who's who around. They're very entrepreneurial, these young guys. I love that about them. They're really fun to be around.
Yeah.
Just, they're just enjoying themselves, and they should do, you know, and they take risks, you know, so they're very entrepreneurial, and I like that about them.
With the accessibility point, that's something, looking from afar, the perception would be that breeding or even young horse production in the US often seems very inaccessible to the, we'll call it the normal person who wants to breed a few foals every year and produce them, in comparison to our own realities in, obviously we're privileged somewhere like Ireland, but say Ireland or even Holland and Belgium, which is maybe a little more expensive than here. But what can the industry in the US do to increase that accessibility or to engage more people in breeding horses?
From the outset, I've done a lot of education. Mm-hmm. So Emily, who I mentioned earlier as the breeding manager, she is 24/7 educating the clients who call about stallions, about, you know, who might match well with my mare. And these are people who may not have the resources to have those discussions. And she knows, she's learned over the years how some stallions breed, what they might pass on, what they might not. She evaluates their mare. She asks for the shortcomings and all that bit. So, and that's all free. You can just call and ask, pick Emily's brain. It used to be my brain they picked, but now they talk to Emily. But that's one of the things. And the other things is, if you breed with a Spycoast horse, and we have a lot of stallions on our roster now, mm-hmm. because we manage a lot of horses that have frozen semen or even that are fresh and some are still in work. And we just, you know, they use our contracts. They use Emily to arrange all the shipping. We do all the work, basically, for a flat fee. And then the people get the benefit of the stud fee. They get that. So where was I going? Oh, so we're able, so if they use one of the Spycoast related stallions, then they or their veterinary can talk directly to our veterinarian, to Dr. Burleson as well. So, you know, we get a lot of, unfortunately, quite a few vets here in the US who don't breed very frequently. They might be, you know, in Montana, and they don't have to do frozen semen, and they've got to drive, you know, 3 hours to get there. So now we're in a situation of, oh, you're supposed to check every 6 hours. Well, I'm not going to drive 3 hours every 6 hours. How are we going to do this? You know, so Dr. Burleson will talk them through how they can do that, or maybe why they want to use fresh instead of frozen then. So we give the breeder the actual opportunity to have that discussion and say, okay, you're going to spend more for the fresh semen, but it's going to work better for you most likely. And so the stallions available to you are far fewer. So, you know, they might be head, and their head might be set on Canaan. Yeah. And you'll be like, okay, yeah, no, you just can't do Canaan. You know, you want to do ICSI and they don't like to do ICSI or whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. we'll walk them through all that. Guide them and say, by the way, you've got a big heavy mare and maybe you don't want to breed to Canaan in any case, right? And so, like, but they don't think that. They just hear the name and see the success of the animal and they want to go in that direction. So we sort of try and work with them, not to necessarily use our stallions, just to get them understanding what the process is. So and then we make some of our younger stallions and available for very inexpensively. So if they just want to get in the game with a decent stallion, but not, you know, the top name one, mm-hmm. they can.
So. Was it those sort of conversations that led you to develop the education center at Spycoast? Or what motivated that?
That came from the fact that I realized at a certain point Spycoast's name was internationally known and we should be an influencer. So not that I'm on social media or know anything about it, but I knew we should be an influencer. And
in
I
the
was
real building, world sense. Yeah.
Yeah, in the real world sense. And I was building a lot of things and paying for a lot of products. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. Why am I not being given more consideration, especially like a sponsorship as a rider would or something like that? So I thought, well, maybe if I build this education center, then this gives pharmaceutical companies, equine product companies, a place to go and highlight and, you know, actually show product. Well, that didn't go over all that well. It's improving. But in the meantime, my staff has started an internship and externship program that became very robust. And we had all these interns and externs around. So I was like, well, okay, then we're going to start really educating. And in order to do that, we need wet stalls and we need a stadium style seating classroom. We've got a ballroom that you can bring the horse right into the ballroom and there's flooring with the drain that they're not going to poop on the rug or anything. And it's attached to the indoor. So we've got a little area that all kinds of people use now. I couldn't believe that there didn't exist something like that. I went online. I was like, why aren't there things like this? Especially in Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah. Next door to the horse park. Yeah.
Next door to the horse park, but next door to Rood and Riddle and yeah. Haggard's and all the thoroughbred industry and everything else. So that thing is busy. We use it a lot and not just we use it, but other people use it a lot. And it's a great way to bring stakeholders in the industry to my staff and my interns and externs. So we don't have to go out and visit everybody. They all know us, which is awesome.
It's very, very clever. And I think any time where you can create situations where people come together to learn together in real life, I think that's when the magic happens.
Everybody loves it. Everybody yeah. loves it. And we have a whole lunch and learn series that goes on once a month, sometimes twice a month. And usually a pharmaceutical company or an equine product company sponsors it. They buy the lunch. And we pretty much fill the room. We've got, I think we average around 75 to 90 people. And these are high school students, college students, staff, veterinarians from different places, product managers, all sorts of folks come in. So it's a good venue.
In terms of your own early days, education in the sport horse breeding world, as we call it, Who do you feel? I know we touched on Shane, but who else do you feel that you learned the most from?
I'd have to say that he was the judge for the BWP NAD. Oh, Bodwin, and I'm not going to remember his last name. I learned a lot from him. He is a true gentleman, and he is very good at educating people about conformation and, the way a horse goes and what you should look at a certain age. And he was very, very gracious in sharing his knowledge with me and the rest of my staff for that matter. I learned a lot from the various trainers that we've had over the years because we had to establish a training program. That was probably the most difficult thing for me because I'm not a rider per se. I topped out at 2.6 hunters, okay? So I'm really not a rider. I didn't start riding really till I was 42, so that's not so bad. But to actually develop a training program that was truly on par with what they were doing in Europe, so that I could, I my goal was to be on the same stage as Europe eventually, and I knew I wasn't going to get there immediately, right? But to give my horses a real chance at it, I had to set that as the bar. And that's the bar we set actually with Youssef as well. We were on the Young Jumper Committee and we had to reset all the specs so that at 5 and 6 and 7, the heights were on a par so that if you want to go to Lanaken, you managed to go, you have that horse, you could go. And that was hard fought actually, but
I'd
we
imagine
got
so.
there. And it's not easy to explain to the smaller breeders why that's necessary, because they may have one or two and they may say, well, but my mare got hurt or she stopped to have a baby, she's not going to be able to make it at the 5 year level. And I'm like, well, then don't take her till she's 6 or 7. Like, not all of mine go all for each one, far from it. I hold, it's too expensive, number one, right? So you hold back and you just take the ones that are ready at that time for that level. And but it's really important to have that in place. And that would be the toughest thing right now, I would say, for American breeders, is we're much further along than they were, but it's very hard to find young horse trainers. And I understand it's not so easy in Europe either, but it's 10 times more difficult here. So that's what we've really been working on, that aspect.
Is there an element of the young horse, we call it pathways, that you feel still really needs to be addressed in the US?
Yes, it would be really desirable to have more local young horse shows. The problem with that is that the really local shows don't necessarily have the understanding of what it takes to build a proper young horse course. It's been very challenging for us, even at the more at the A shows, the double A shows, to get the course designers to design a course that's appropriate for young horses. Because like at WEF, they come in, it's week five, and they want to, oh, they're at WEF and they want to make their mark and this and that. And it's like, no, you don't understand. We have to go from week one and work our way up to week 12, and you're at week five. You're not at week 12. And there's that. And then there's, oh, the meter 30 is coming in there after the 5, 6, and 7 year olds are done into that ring. So they want to have the course already set to save time. I mean, there are real practical reasons why it's difficult for the show managers to give us what we want, right? To say nothing of the finances, right? It's very expensive to have a horse at WEF. So how do you, so I fought very hard being an owner at the time to have it subsidized because they said, listen, these are the horses that are going to be coming to WEF. And if we want to build the numbers, you want them to come as young horses and buy in to why WEF is a good place to go. So they really made the cost of those classes much lower. But again, we have no control over like the other added costs that USAF puts on it for drug testing and this, that, and the other thing. So they end up being expensive anyway. And there are some places where you can go and do it for $20 or for nothing at all. I think Blenheim was saying, oh, we're just going to have a non-horse show and let you come in and ride a decent course. Locally, places have managed to make it work. You know, they see the importance. So like Texas and Princeton and Tryon and Wellington and Blenheim and, you know, a few other places have figured out systems that work for their locales, and that's great. But you know, it is still expensive to bring on a horse in the United States. There's no doubt about it.
And something else, I've only been at, I think, horse shows in the US, I think, three times, but twice was at WEF in Wellington. And I was amazed that you could go around to all the different rings. There was so much going on at all times. And all levels, and it was so rare to hear where a horse was from, what a horse was by. And the one thing you can be 100% sure you are not going to hear was who bred the horse.
Right.
And what I'm wondering is, you've gone from owner to breeder and then to one of the biggest sport horse breeders in the US. You've been in all these conversations or wrestles with the likes of USAF to try and improve the registration, the quality of the breeding information, the standard of the young horse classes. Do you think it's possible to get any sort of breeder recognition in the US? Because there seems to be only a small number of little nods, maybe once a year, there's a breeder of the year based on kind of points, but beyond an award ceremony once a year, there seems to be little to no breeder recognition, and that's universal. But I'm wondering, yeah, obviously you're seeing the US the most.
Yeah, so that's pretty much show independent. You know, pretty much the shows are determining when that gets done and when that doesn't get done. There's no like universal method of, you know, putting it on the order of go or something like that. Believe me, I've been trying for many, many years to get it on the order of go. And it is for like FEI comp for the Grand Prix.
The breeding
is on, not the breeder. So we've gotten that far. That was my first, you know, I just had to get it to that at least.
Yeah.
And people are talking about their breeding more. The young kids coming on and stuff. Diane Langer worked with the emerging athletes, said, you've got to know the pedigree of your horse you're on. You should have a young horse that you're bringing on. She's definitely made some headway with the younger generation. And the fact that the horses are so expensive now, the top horses, they're having to buy younger. Okay. So that changes the equation a little bit too. Mm-hmm. We do breeder awards for, in most cases, when they have young horse finals, there are breeder awards.
Okay.
But you're right. They're not announced consistently. Why it's so difficult, I honestly couldn't tell you. Especially with American bred horses. But I will say the inroads that we have made are vast, because people used to import the horse and literally throw the paperwork away. And that was it. You didn't know. And so believe me, my friends who work for like at North American Stud, and they also have a little business where they try and track horses that you don't know who they are, but they have a brand on their butt, you know, so you know. They're registered somewhere. And that's actually a little business here in the United States, trying to track down who those horses are, because people might want to breed to them. And then where do they start with the pedigree? So, you know, we really made inroads into, actually, people do keep their paperwork now. That's huge, because it used to be poor Jen Glosson at WEF. You know, she'd do all the intakes to have the young horse classes in the show office. And, you know, they wouldn't bring her the paperwork. So like she couldn't put down the pedigree. She couldn't put down the breeder. You have to have paperwork for that if they come from overseas. Well, and even if they're in America, obviously, but it's been a logistical nightmare. Mm-hmm. But you have to be patient. Change happens slowly. I believe now that we have the pedigrees actually, and remember the database was no good, but now the registries are working with USEF in order to get the database better. And then we had the whole argument about who owns the data. That was a nightmare. Everybody thought they were going to make millions on the data that they had, and all the registries didn't want to give the data. And it's like, stop fighting and let's just start getting the data out there so people can, like the breeders can use it, the sellers can use it, the people buying horses can use it. You know, your data isn't going to be that important to something to make you money if you don't share the information. So that's been another thing.
When I'm looking back, I think I got a memory yesterday that on Instagram or Facebook that it was 6 years since I was at WEF. And if I think now, even just on the breeding side, even that I think the breeder recognition is an even longer road. But even the breeding recently, watching Grand Prix in WEF and hearing, you know, Danny Waldman and Stephen Wild actually even saying what a horse is by was such a novelty.
Yes.
Now.
Yes.
Or even making commentary on, you know, different ones by the same stallions, and the conversation is happening, which is great. Obviously,
yes,
Danny and Alan have their own breeding program. It's of interest to them, but it's great now with a few commentators,
yes,
hearing them talk about that. But is there anything you think, and this is internationally, is there anything you think could be done to improve that breeder recognition? Because I think that supports and increases the participation conversation element as well.
I'm sure there are some things that could be done. I mean, look, Ireland does one of the best jobs of it. If everybody went to the RDS and saw the young horse competitions there and how they, you know, honor the breeders and how many people are there and how enthusiastic they are and all this stuff, that's all you need to see, you know. If you saw that, you'd get it, right? And there's no... I mean, or if they went to WBFSH and Zangerside, the finals. I mean, it's so encouraging and exciting. We're not there yet. We haven't reached critical mass to do it in the United States. I can't speak for the whole world. We'll get there. I think GEG buying Wellington is actually a very good thing with regard to that, because they're going to bring sort of the European take on how to run a show that will honor the young horses. Lovsta having taken over some of the young horse classes as a sponsor, they're going to take this very seriously, and people are going to take them seriously. Yeah. See, when Spy Coast was doing it, they're like, oh, there she is, that crazy lady doing her breeding thing. But when you get Lovsta doing it, they're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, maybe this is important. I think it'll get there. I really do think it'll get there. It's just like everything else. It takes time. And we don't get any subsidies. The breeding industry here in the United States, nothing. Like, we don't get anything, any support from our government. So they're not promoting us either. There's no greater good seen here. You know, but I don't think we need it. I think we can get there. And honestly, the Europeans are helping, because they are putting the prices so high that people now realize, oh, Tycho's is really breeding decent horses, and I can get it at 6 and 7 for much less, then maybe I'll take a shot at that. And actually, we've had good success with that. We've got some really good horses that have gone out there. I've maybe sold for, you know, 400, and somebody's gotten 800, and then the next person's got over 1 million for. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's what we're looking to do.
It's a win for everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. And all you need to do is have, even small breeders, all they need to have is one of those or two of those every few years and they can maintain their program. But you need to have people believe that they can produce them, both put them on the ground and produce them as riding horses adequately to invest in.
Yeah. From your time as a breeder and an owner, I'd like to know what your proudest day or moment is in each, with each hat. So as a breeder and as an owner.
Oh, okay. As a breeder, it hasn't quite happened yet, but it's about to, I think. Getting my first true homebred into a big Grand Prix, that's been pretty special. There's lots of other things that I'm very proud of and have been wonderful days and moments in terms of breeding. But I think that, like, I don't need to go to the Olympics and win the Olympics, but if I were to get one of my homebred horses into the Olympics, that would be the pinnacle of it for me. You know, who knows if it'll ever happen, but that to me must be the top, you know, and I don't have to have it win the gold medal. I just have to have it get there. That'll be unbelievable. In my lifetime would be even better. As far as being an owner, probably the most fun for me was when Shane and Shaki Z were on mm-hmm. the European final. You know, they won the gold on the team. Yeah. That was pretty cool. I really wished I had been there for the last RDS when he did so well on James Cancruz to win the Nations Cup. That would have been very special to be there, especially because it's an Irish bred horse. I can really appreciate what that means to the Irish to have that happen.
That was so special, yeah. And I suppose what was special about that, you had two Irish riders with these two young superstars. You had Cian with Kilkenny, Shane with James Cancruz. Yeah. And for them to win any Nations Cup with two Irish bred horses is incredible. But to win the Aga Khan in Dublin. And then what was amazing was in the prize giving, we got the breeders of Kilkenny, Tom and Sinead Brennan, and then the breeders of James Cancruz with Patrick and Shane Connolly into the prize giving. And for them to be a part of that and pictures with trophies.
It's huge.
You couldn't buy it.
That's huge.
That inspires the rest of us. That it shows what's possible.
Well, y'all have come a good way from even 10 years ago.
Definitely.
There was so much talk about how you'd let all the bloodlines go, how you weren't, you know, breeding for the current level of the sport or the current type of sport and all that sort of stuff. Well, you guys turned on a dime in terms of breeding. And to have the kind of horses that you have out there doing so well, it didn't take Ireland long to turn it around. And I really applaud that. That's amazing. I don't know of how many other countries that could do that. You know, they get in there, a lot of these places get in their own lane and they struggle to get out of it. And there's a lot of people, there are registries that really are still trying to control their bloodlines. And, you know, their wins are going down, 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 down. It's like, no, you have to inject new blood and new bloodlines into your lines in order to keep them viable. You always have to move forward.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, and that's the one worry. And I know they're addressing it with the whole Mares of Macho thing where they breed to just certain stallions, the top stallions and stuff. They're going to have to be very mindful that they don't get into that cycle as well. And they know that. I think they're really definitely moving forward. And the mares, they're moving forward because they're using some of the sisters and daughters and things like that. So that it is moving forward. There's other blood in there.
That is probably one of the main issues, just even as an onlooker on the ICSI front. It's actually not so much with the process, and this isn't Mares of Macha, it's just whoever's doing ICSI. Like if somebody rings and they want to know what stallion to use or I feel sometimes it's actually a pointless conversation because once they tell me that they're doing ICSI, it's generally going to be one of five or six stallions, regardless of what their mare is, what their mare needs, how she's breeding, what their market is.
And that's marketing, right? It's not only marketing, it's marketing in terms of they're thinking about how they're going to sell the embryo or the foal. That's what they're marketing toward the buyer. I'm not saying it's marketing about how many Chaco Blues there are. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about why you'd breed a Chaco Blue, because there are so many out there and they've been successful and people want them. So that's what they're marketing toward. You know, and there are people that are, especially in America, I'd have to say, that aren't as well educated about all the stallions that are available, that they just look at the top 10 list and they're going to say, okay, I want that one or that one. They don't want to take a risk because they're only going to breed, you know, five or six horses in their lifetime if they own a particular mare that they love. And they want one of the top horses. So you can totally understand that, right? They're working with the numbers, but those of us who breed more horses, and that's our business to do it, I think we have to breed to a variety of animals to prove them out. I mean, you can't stop doing that, right? It's not necessarily going to give you your best odds, but you have to move it forward at the same time.
With the,
in my opinion.
Yeah, no, and I'd agree. And I think variety in every aspect of breeding, whether it's just a breeding program in general or whether mm-hmm. it's availing of ICSI or whatever, I think variety is important. On the registration and the stud book side, you've in the past you did a lot with BWP in North America. It now seems to be with the North American stud book. Why do you think stud books and inspections and approvals are important? Because it's still, again, just looking from the outside in, it still seems like mare inspections and things like that are still something that you support.
Well, as I was saying, Bodwin Schweppers, I might be mispronouncing his name, but now I remember it. I learned a lot from him. And I think especially if you're a new breeder, that's super helpful, you know, to actually have your mares and your foals inspected. I think you just learn a lot from that process. If you have a good inspector, most of them, that's their job. I think that's super helpful. I was going to mention that the other day when Danny was doing the commentary on my mare out of the blue SCF and the announcer, not Danny, said, this is a Belgian bred mare. Well, it's not. It's an American bred mare. It's just BWP AD, and they always drop off the NAD.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it happen over at Lonikin as well when Tom Grossman had his horses go and they were BWP NAD and they call them Belgian bred. So that is one of the reasons why people are switching. Also, it's just less expensive to go with the North American stud book. They don't have as many add-ons, if you will. And he's trying to encourage breeding and registering in the United States. It's a good friend of mine, Jean-Yves Tola, runs the North American stud book as well as the Sel Francais stud book over here. It's devastating to me to have that announcer say, this is Belgian bred.
You hit on a serious pet peeve of mine, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because there are breeders listening to this from a variety of different countries. And I have no affiliation with any particular stud book, but I think what's important, and we would have said this on a trip last year with, say, when we were dealing with that group from New Zealand as well, and the importance of, yes, any of us, we're in the situation where we can register anywhere in theory. I don't care in any country which stud book you register with, but register with one that is clearly identifiable as American, New Zealand, Irish, because we had the same problem here, where for different reasons, sometimes it was a fallout with an organization or whatever, but for different reasons, people registered with stud books outside of Ireland. And it pained me in the same way to see horses going out, competing, succeeding at a high level, and being referred to as Belgian or Dutch when they were bred in Ireland. And so I'm glad you touched on that, because sometimes people can get caught up in maybe a flashier, slick stud book that is full of promises. But I think for the success of any breeding industry in a specific country, it's important that all the successful horses bred in that country are acknowledged as being
Well, that
American.
was, and also, if you do have an aspiration to take your young horses to Lanaken or wherever the Young Horse Federation will have their finals, now I'm in the pot with the Belgians. If it's a sister organization, now some of them are distinctly different, but most of them are linked. And now I'm up against all the other Belgians as to who gets picked. Now, who's going to get picked? The horse over in America or the Belgian horses? And then I have to go in a wild card situation or buy a table or whatever I have to do, right? Now, with the North American Stud and its World Breeding Federation for Sport Horses approved, I go as a North American Stud Book horse.
That's
You
part of their
know,
allocation.
I, as part of their allocation, I earned it, I could go. Those horses, I think, are now four, so I haven't gotten there yet.
You have time
But
to plan the trip.
I have time to plan the trip. You know, you should always give credit where credit is due, right? I mean, that's just part of it. But and it's easy for them to take credit for the ones that hit and not have to deal with the ones that don't, right? I think that is important. And so I'm just going to do a little plug here. One of my bred horses, who I sold to an American, just won the U25 final, you know, the whole circuit
Series.
series. And so for that, she's going to go over to Aachen and a couple of others, I think. They're going to, you know, Hermes is paying to send her over and show in Aachen. And first thing I did was I said, you make sure in your bio you say that this is an American bred horse, because sure as shooting, they're going to call that a Belgian bred horse. I said, this is a BWP NAD horse, and it was bred in the United States. And please make sure that's in your bio, because she should be proud that she thought to buy an American horse. And she brought that horse along on her own, which she did. And, you know, she didn't buy a made horse or anything else. She bought that horse young. She brought it along. She trusted in American breeding, and she did well with it. And I want her to get full credit for that. And I want me to get credit for that.
And on that note,
Yeah.
the name of the rider and the name of the horse, and tell us how it's
The
bred.
rider is Summer Hill, and the horse is La Belle SCF. It's out of Belle Blue, who was a horse that actually Kaylee Tamayo won. I don't know, was the U25, but I think it maybe was the U25 series on, and by Dictator van de Boslenhove, who's a Spycoast stallion. Yep, bred
Great.
in Belgium. But so anyway, it's kind of it's a success story. And I want, you know, when Out of the Blue goes over to show in Europe, which the plan is this summer, I want her to be announced as an American bred horse as well.
And that's the beauty of the Thoroughbred situation, is whatever country they drop in, it's USA, it's IRE. There's no this stud book, that stud book. That I love that system. I actually wish that that was the same in the sport horses, that it was just
And even further than that, they do it by state over here, because there's all kinds of
like premiums or
premiums and bonuses and things. If you are New York bred versus Kentucky bred or Maryland bred, they all have different bonuses and things for those horses. Something to think about.
definitely. My second last question. I'm conscious you're a very busy individual. Even
I cleared time.
when we were starting this conversation, like like I was saying to you in our chat before we started the interview, you are doing a lot. You even Spy Coast Farm, like if you think of it, if you just heard Spy Coast Farm, you know, I know that it was a breeding farm in Kentucky, but this, even that alone, there's so many different aspects and legs to that. That's in Kentucky. You're currently in Wellington. You have a farm there. There's so much through being an owner, a sponsor, a breeder, philanthropy. There's so many different aspects that you have to manage. And I don't know how they're all managed. One of the things that I saw that you were quite involved in is actually in mentoring other women. And what I was thinking of, and just something important that I wanted to touch on before I get on to the last question, is I'm conscious that there are lots of young women, lots of different countries who listen to this podcast and who are going to be starting out in their own businesses or who have existing businesses. In terms of them pursuing their own business in the, well, in the horse industry or any industry, maybe they have another business in another sector and horses are the hobby. What advice would you have to those young ladies?
I get this question quite a bit, and I've got an answer to this question. And I tell this to my daughter, to my daughter's friends, all kinds of, and men too, doesn't matter. Establish your skill set. It doesn't matter what it is. It's could be like I started out, I learned standard first aid when I was 12. And then I went on to learn lifeguarding and da, da, da. And then I became a nurse. And then, you know, then I became, then I got my master's in management. Through that time, I took accounting and I took this. You're building your skill set and just continue to build your skill set. And then whatever it is you do, it will benefit from that. You never know, but you know, the last thing I want to take is accounting. Okay. I am not an accounting kind of gal. All right. But it's helped me in so many ways to know that. So don't stick just in one lane and only learn about horses, let's say. You have to go outside of that and learn different things, because that's what gives you the opportunity to look at the breadth of the situation, at the industry itself, let's say, or pivot, because things change. One of the questions you gave me was, has my mission changed? And it has changed. We've actually kind of accomplished what we first set out to do. So we've pivoted. And in life, you have to pivot. It might be, you know, having children, it might be getting a divorce, it might be whatever, you know, moving. You have to have the skill set that if you have to pivot, you can do that now, or, you know, and bring in things so that you can pivot, you know, learn other new skill sets to do that. So that's one of the things I tell younger people, is to build your toolkit, have it be as deep and as broad as you can. And then I always say, and this is the little bit weirder thing, is to keep your finger in the air. Just pay attention to which way the wind is blowing, because that's what's going to tell you where you can take advantage of something, where you can, I, as an entrepreneur, I look for the holes. I look for something that's not being taken care of. And then that's what I take care of. That's where I go, because that's where the opportunity is. So you can make ice cream. Let's say you have an ice cream shop and that's your business, and make ice cream. But as soon as you hear of, like, everybody's talking about goji berries, make goji berry ice cream. You know what I mean? It's like, you just listen up to what people are talking about, and then see where you, then try and go in that direction. Stay current. Stay current. Don't stay in the past. Stay at least current and always move forward. That's usually the advice I give to people. And then go for it. Take a risk. You're never going to gain if you don't take a risk. You know, life isn't coming crashing to a halt because you fail at something. You just pick up and you're going to learn something from it. And then you keep going.
there's a lot of that is applicable to the question that I usually end each interview with. I'll ask the question in case there's anything that you would add specifically to breeding, but an awful lot of that, whether it's breeding or life in general, it's going to be relevant to both. The question that I finish each interview with is always, what advice would you offer to a young person or to someone at the start of their breeding program? So specifically in terms of breeding, is there anything that you would add to the general advice that we just touched on?
At this point in time, I would say breed the best you can get to the best you can get. Now, it's funny because if you're in the United States, a lot of people try and breed hunters. Hunters, they sell well, they bring a lot of money in some cases, but it's very difficult to breed a hunter because to me, a hunter is something that it's like a jumper that jumps in really good form, but isn't going to jump at high heights and has a very quiet personality. But people believe in breeding hunters here. Well, breed the best hunters to the best hunters that you could possibly get if that's what you're going to do. And in Europe, if what you wanted to do is breed show jumpers, breed the best ones to the best ones you possibly can. That to me, and this isn't a plug, that's why Mares of Matcha has been an equalizer to me. Go for the best bloodlines you can get. And if that's finding a mare who's broken down, or if that's, you know, bartering for an embryo from your friend's mare bred to a certain stallion, just get creative. One of the reasons why I started the Rehab and Fitness Center was so that I could encourage people to breed, to get embryos off of their mares when they were out of work and collect their stallions while they were out of work. And what that turned into was a barter situation for me too. I was able to say to a professional, let's say a young professional had a really good mare that I admired, hey, I'll rehab your mare for 3 months if I can get an embryo off of her. Didn't cost him anything. I got the great genetic material. Be creative, you know, figure out a way that you can, if you're a farrier, you know, I'll give you a year's worth of farrier services if I can get an embryo off of this mare, something like that, you know, just figure out what you can give somebody to get from them that's going to be mutually agreeable. And you just have to be creative to figure that out. You know, I'm not a farrier, I'm not a vet, I'm not a rider, I'm nothing. None of those things. So I don't have any sweat equity really to put into this except administration, which is what I do. So use your skill set to parlay and into starting it. That's, I guess, what I would say.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?